I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. Welcome to the Executive Access Podcast. Mike Daly played college baseball at LSU, winning national championships in both 1997 and 2000. He never played professionally, but took an alternate route into the game instead, earning a master's degree in sports administration before embarking on a career in major league front offices. Following a lengthy stint with the Cleveland Indians, Daly joined the Texas Rangers prior to the 2007 season, working his way through the front office for nearly a decade before being named assistant general manager in November of 2016. I sat down with Daly to discuss the challenges of running a farm system, the key to identifying international talent, and much more. Enjoy this conversation with Rangers assistant general manager, Mike Daly. Here with Texas Rangers assistant general manager, Major League Operations and International Scouting, Mike Daly. Mike, how are you?
Outstanding. Mark, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for taking the time to do this. So you were raised in Atlanta and Cincinnati. Who's your favorite team?
I grew up as a diehard Braves fan. That was back in the 80s when they weren't too good. You know, Bob Horner and Dale Murphy, a huge Dale Murphy fan. And then when the team got really good in 1991, that was I was about 12 years old. And I remember, you know, everything about the comeback against the Dodgers. And, you know, huge fan of, you know, what the Braves did, you know, going on to, you know, 14 years of incredible success. But that was right in my wheelhouse with the Atlanta Braves back in the early 90s when they really turned it around down there.
I've talked to a lot of people who said they were Braves fans growing up, and most of them it's because they lived somewhere where they didn't have a big league team and TBS was the only thing that showed baseball. So being a Braves fan in Atlanta, I'm sure you went out to Fulton County Stadium a lot and actually got to watch the team.
Absolutely. And my birthday is, you know, like the first week of April, so many times I was out there with my having a birthday party out there in right center field, and it was good. I mean, some of those teams as they were coming up, you remember them clearly, but what it was like going to the World Series in 1990. I went to game 5 of the 1991 World Series against Minnesota, and you know, just to be, you know, locked in at, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, you remember all those games and, you know, what it was like to be at Fulton County Stadium with the Tomahawk Chop.
You played baseball at LSU, won national championships in 97 and 2000. What was it like as a teenager to experience, or I guess you're probably 20 or so the second time, what was it like to experience that kind of success on that kind of stage?
Yeah, I would use like the term play very loosely. I was I was lucky enough to be on the team. I was you know, lucky enough to get an opportunity as a walk-on to the, you know, LSU baseball team, and it was like a PhD in baseball, you know, honestly. You know, like to be able to be down there and to learn from probably like the greatest, you know, college coach ever, and Skip Bertman, and just to kind of be like a fly on the wall, and, you know, whether it's, you know, catching bullpens, or, you know, and, you know, watching Coach Bertman work with the pitchers, or to be in the cages and to learn from, you know, Jim Schwanke and, you know, Turtle Thomas, and to see how they were coaching, but then ultimately just to see what Coach Bertman did as a coach, as a head coach, how he motivated, how he taught the game, you know, everything. Those, you know, 4 years were unbelievable to my development as a scout and executive, you know, moving forward. But unbelievable experience to be able to, you know, be down there, and very, very lucky to be, you know, part of two national championship teams.
So you never had the aspirations or realistic belief that playing pro ball was going to be in your future?
I mean, I think everybody has the aspirations. I think when you walk out there in the fall of 1996 to a second base and there are six other players out there, and all of them have been drafted, you realize pretty quick that it's going to be a challenge just to get on the field at LSU, much less, you know, have the opportunity to play professionally. But sure, that's always the dream, to be able to play professionally. But I knew pretty quick that if I wanted to be in baseball, it was going to be in a different capacity.
So you go on to get your bachelor's in marketing at LSU, you get an MBA and a master's in sports administration at Ohio University. You knew baseball was where you wanted to head at that point?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I wanted to, you know, even kind of growing up in high school, whenever we would go play, you know, summer tournaments all over the country, always wanted to go to see, like, the minor league ballpark, you know, went to Augusta, went to Knoxville, went to these different, you know, minor league ballparks, kind of introduced myself to, you know, people then, you know, just to kind of get a feel, you know, what it was like to work in a baseball. But it was always something that I wanted to do even from a very, very young age. I knew that I aspired to be, you know, working in a baseball in the future.
Aside from players, which obviously every kid watching their team that have their favorite players, knowing maybe in college or as you were graduating that you wanted to get into the game on the other side, were there executives that you admired from afar before you actually got into the game and started meeting people?
I didn't really know too many executives, you know, growing up as a Braves fan, it seemed like every July, John Schuerholz would pull off like a big time trade to, you know, help the Braves on their playoff run. So, you know, being a Braves fan, you know, growing up and then moving on to Cincinnati, and they had some good teams there. 1995, making the playoffs, but you knew about Jim Bowden. But you know, I think John Schuerholz and what he was able to do as a leader of the Braves was something that always stood out in my mind.
Pre-internet, I don't think fans knew a whole lot of executives that weren't maybe their own team's GM, if they even knew their own team's GM. Has the way that fans take in the game, whether it's Twitter, social media, the internet, websites, newspapers, Baseball America, MLB.com, whatever it may be, there's so much information out there. Do you think that executives, I mean, now if you ask a good baseball fan, maybe not, my mom wouldn't know, but
sure,
you ask a good baseball fan, name 10 GMs, they're probably not going to have trouble doing that. That wasn't the case when we were growing up.
I don't think so. I mean, it was tough enough to get stats. I mean, it was like a big day there.
Wednesday, USA Today.
Absolutely. Baseball Weekly, you would get it there, and you get all the like the big league stats, but then Baseball America, and it was, at the time, it was the American League, and then like the following issue was the National League, and then to be able to look at all those stats and to try to keep up with the various players. So, yeah, it's changed by light years between 20 years ago to now, with the way that people consume information and the access that everybody has, not only stats but general managers, major league team, etc.
My kids don't believe me when I tell them that when I was in high school and we played in a rotisserie baseball league, that we had to do our own stats by hand, and you could only do them once a week because you only had the stats once a week. They think I'm kidding because everything's so instant now. You're live scoring on games. But that's how baseball fans had to consume that stuff, and it's not that long ago. You're talking about 25 years ago.
No, absolutely. And I remember, sitting on the bus there at LSU, some of the midweek games, and I'd have, the Baseball America open, and I'm, trying to read up on everything, and some of my teammates are kind of looking at me like, what are you doing? But that's how much I enjoyed baseball. That's how much I, consumed baseball, and that was, the only way to do it was, either Baseball Weekly or, Baseball America, and, get the hard copy and, throw it in your backpack. But just trying to constantly get as much information as you could. I mean, that was the only way to do it.
So you want to get into baseball. How do you actually go about doing that and trying to get a job?
I think, what I've kind of learned, early on was that you have to put yourself out there, that you have to make yourself available. I was able, in 1997, after completing a redshirt year there at LSU, I, went to the New Jersey Cardinals, played for the Sussex County Generals at the time, and I walked into a Tony Torre's office. He was the general manager there, and I said, hey, I'm up here for the summer, and I'd love to see if I could get an internship here. And he was nice enough to give me that opportunity. It was $35 every home game, so even when the team was on the road, you were expected to work. And from New Jersey Cardinals in 97 onto the Philadelphia Phillies in the ticket office and in 1998. And along the way at LSU, you're able to meet people. Coach Burtman knew that I had a strong interest in working in a baseball. He introduced me to a Jim Hendry, who was at the time the scouting director for the Cubs, but he had a relationship there from a Jim Hendry back in the days of a Miami. Jim Hendry gave me an opportunity to a bird dog in 2000 to kind of get into the scouting and personnel side down there in Louisiana and Mississippi, to be able to see players and to start to kind of get my database of what players look like. So I was lucky with a number of opportunities to continue just to kind of put myself out there. I went 1997. I went to the winter meetings for the first time as a 19-year-old. I was actually down there in New Orleans, so I just drove down there. In 1997, I was able to meet more people, and base every year since, except for one, I've been at the winter meetings. So I've been very, very lucky. Some of the opportunities that I've had to be able to meet people, but I've been blessed by the opportunities that people have provided me to be able to get into the game.
Based on the weather alone, I hope it was the Indianapolis one that you missed, because that one was miserable.
I think it was the Anaheim one. It was so far away from I was living. But yeah, I was up at that Indianapolis one. It was freezing.
It was like ice and hailstorms the whole time.
Absolutely.
It's like you step out of the hotel, you're like, oh, I'm leaving the hotel. This is terrible. So you mentioned you had the chance to bird dog, and you started getting your scouting sort of feet under you there. How do you learn to do that? I mean, you've played baseball, you know how to play the game,
yeah,
but having an eye for the game feels like it's a different skill.
Yeah.
So how do you learn to go about doing that?
You make a lot of mistakes. I mean, you go out there and you see players, and it's just different being behind the fence, but you go out there and you look at players, you have an idea, you continue to see players, you talk to other people, you talk to other scouts, you talk to recruiting coordinators, you talk to folks who have, you know, done it before you to kind of understand what they see. Maybe they're, you know, nice enough to, you know, share with you some of the mistakes that they made along the way. Maybe they're nice enough to, you know, share with you some of the things that they believe in that have, you know, kind of, you know, proven to be true in their scouting careers. So I just think it's a lot about, you know, seeing players as much as you can, but then asking questions and, you know, being open to input, and then ultimately developing your own way of evaluating, and then your own belief system.
So the first team you join on with in any sort of a full-time capacity, the Cleveland Indians, you worked in their baseball operations department 2001-2002. Could you tell how talented a group you were working with? Many of those guys that you've worked with have gone on to become GMs elsewhere and have, you know, had very lengthy careers.
Absolutely. Well, my expectation going in is that, like, the people in a major league front office are at such a high level. But, you know, being able to, you know, join the front office and then to see the, you know, caliber of person in that office was amazing, you know. And like at the time, I was lucky enough to get that position with Cleveland, and I was in graduate school at Ohio University, and I was going back and forth between Athens, Ohio, and Cleveland. So I would go up on a Thursdays, and I'd work Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Sunday afternoon I'd drive back down 180 plus miles down to Athens, and then go back to grad school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then back up to Cleveland, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But, you know, just to kind of be, you know, in that office and to be exposed to those people, it was amazing. And then kind of what I remember on the very, very first day on the job, April 5th, 2001, I believe, I show up in a coat and tie, kind of like what any intern might do. I was making $500 a month. Could not have been happier. I go in the front, in the front door, and Scott Barnsby, who's been with Cleveland forever, just got named the scouting director this past offseason, you know, greets me and says, "Yeah, I kind of say half joking, hey, there might be like a press conference for a, you know, $500 a month intern." He goes, "There's no, you know, press conference for you, but there's a press conference today." And I'm kind of like, okay. And he didn't kind of tell me anything else. And we go up to the fourth floor. My first, very, very first job was to rip up old draft scout books. I mean, there were books and books and books and paper and paper. And my job was just to rip them up. So, you know, throw them away. But as I'm ripping them up, the phones are blowing up all in the office. This is not really like cell phones, and there really isn't Twitter going on, but the phones keep going. I'm just thinking in the back of my mind, like, this is even more than I thought. I mean,
something's happening here.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if this is just like a normal day or if this is what it's always like. So Scott, you know, grabs me like a couple hours later and says, "Hey, we're going down to the press conference. John Hart's going to announce his retirement at the end of the year." So I, you know, go down to the press conference, and I'm sitting next to Mike Hazen, who's a fellow intern for me. Ross Atkins is the assistant farm director. Neil Huntington is the farm director. Chris Antonetti is the assistant baseball operations. Brad Grant, who's the assistant scouting director, became like their scouting director, who's been there for 23 years. I think that John Mirabelli was there as well. And then you look up at the microphone, there's, you know, John Hart and Mark Shapiro. And I'm thinking, like, there are 11 or 12 kind of cameras, it seemed at the time. It was just unbelievable, you know, first day on the job that you're sitting there. And, you know, looking back, you know, 17 years later, like, you know, how many people were in that room and what that, you know, front office was like, and the opportunity and the people you meet. And like the following year, when, you know, Mark becomes the GM, in comes John Farrell as the, you know, farm director, and then have the opportunity to spend 2001 working for, you know, Ross and Neil, and then the following year work for Ross and John Farrell before I, you know, went out to, you know, take an area job, was just unbelievable. But those people and everything that I learned there in those 2 years in the front office still, you know, sticks with me to this day.
I feel like the GM meetings nowadays must just be like a big reunion of old Indians people, right? Like, you all, it seems like 70% of the people that I've talked to for this series have worked under Mark Shapiro at the Indians at some point during their career.
You know, maybe it is. I was very, very lucky on that opportunity, and unbelievable people to have the opportunity to, you know, work with, and most importantly, learn under. But yeah, I mean, Mark Shapiro was like the driver of that, and it was just you know, unbelievable experience for me. And like I said, you know, very, very lucky.
I know this is a very wide ranging question, and it might be hard to narrow it down to one thing, but what's the one takeaway, the one thing you learned most working under Mark?
The thing that I learned the most, you know, learning under Mark, is the value of people. So that's that same year, you know, I'm on the job for, you know, 2 months, and I'm making $500 a month, and my grandfather passes away there in Philadelphia. And it's, like I said, it's like a few days, like, ahead of the draft, and I'm not going to go home. Like, I'm not going to, like the funeral. I'm going to sit there because it's the draft, and I need to be in the draft. I'm an intern, and somebody's got to move the magnets, and somebody's got to make sure that we got, you know, bagels ready, and, like, the coffee's hot, and And Mark heard about it. And you know, I had very, very small interaction with Mark. He's the general manager. I'm, you know, like an intern. But I remember Mark distinctly walking back to where I was at my desk. And he says, hey, you're going home. And Mark, you don't need me to, you know, go home. I can stay. I can help out with the draft. He goes, you're going home. I go, Mark, I'm good. He goes, come here. So he basically walks me over to the traveling secretary, the travel agent in the office, and says, book him a flight back to Philadelphia. I'm paying for it, and no questions asked. I'm like, okay. And like, and the flight was $1,000. It was basically 2 months of salary, just like that. And I still kept the receipt. I still have the receipt to this day. And the one thing that always sticks, you know, sticks out to me is how, you know, Mark Shapiro treated me, but treated everybody. And I went home. It was the 100% right thing to do. And as I've, you know, been lucky enough to, you know, grow my career, I was, you know, go back to how Mark, you know, treated people and make sure that I try to, you know, treat people in the same manner that, you know, Mark treated me.
Wow, that's a great story. You went on to serve as an area scout for the Indians 2003 to 2006. Josh Tomlin was one of the guys you signed. You've seen him go on to a successful career. He played a big role in that Indians 2016 playoff run. You said before, when you're learning how to scout, you make a lot of mistakes. How satisfying is it when you hit on somebody like that?
Tremendously, but like I said, there were a lot of mistakes before Josh Tomlin there in 2006. But I think the opportunity to leave the office, you know, they entrusted me, you know, 24 years old, to go out to Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa, and to really go out there and you know, really focus on seeing players each and every day. And they, you know, Brad Grant was great to me. John Mirabelli was great to me. Kenny Stauffer was my first cross checker. He had unbelievable patience, you know, with me as he, you know, helped me and grew me. But yeah, I mean, just the opportunity to go out there and scout and to really, you know, see players and make mistakes. And you look back at all the players that came out of the Midwest, you know, over those years. And after 3 years there in Kansas City, I got the opportunity to move down to a North Texas and Oklahoma and North Louisiana with the Indians. But I look back at those 4 years, and they were very, very important to my career because I felt that I, you know, really gained a great understanding of scouting and the importance of scouting.
So you mentioned the first area you were was a four-state coverage. Then you moved down to a three-state coverage. 2003 to 2006, the internet's there, but it's, you know, certainly growing in certain aspects. Mm-hmm. How hard is it to find out who you should be watching, who you should be going to see? I mean, you're talking about a four-state region.
Yeah.
It's not like, well, I just got to watch these three schools. I mean, you've
Definitely.
Got colleges, you've got high schools. I'm sure every coach wants you to come see their guy, but you have to decide, is it worth my drive to Nebraska
yeah.
to go see this guy? So how do you go about figuring out
sure.
who you want to go see?
Envelopes and stamps. I mean, you know, Scott Meany was another guy with Cleveland I learned like a great deal from. Sent me like a letter about, you know, basically to send out to all coaches, high school coaches, junior college coaches. You don't realize how many small schools are in the state of Iowa. You don't realize how many junior colleges are in Kansas. You don't realize how many schools. And I would sit there when the, you know, like a freezing cold day that in, you know, Kansas City in mid-December, and I would, you know, print out all these letters to the coaches and say, hey, my name is Mike Daly, and I'm the area scout. Or, you know, would you send me your schedule? And then on the back of the piece of paper is, would you, you know, list a couple players on your team who you think might be professional players? And then are there any players in your area that you would, you know, look at as, you know, possible professional players? So I would sit there with a stack of, you know, papers, and I would, you know, fold them up and get like the sponge and with some water and
right.
you know, put the stamp on it, and I would go to the, you know, mailbox or, you know, post office with, you know, six huge boxes, and I would, you know, dump them all in. I would wait for it to come back, and, you know, various kind of, you know, coaches, maybe you got 10% back, maybe you got 20% back. But one thing that I will say is, so I get one back from Concordia High School in Concordia, Kansas, and it's in the boondocks. It's that, you know, way out west, out there by Manhattan, Kansas. So I get one from a coach, Gerald Sorrell, and on the back there's a guy named Jared Gettert. So I just kind of like, I file it away, and I'm out there watching the junior college. I'm not really like thinking about it. And I see like the Concordia High School baseball team go out to practice. And I'm thinking, I think that I got like a letter back from one of these guys. So I like go in, like into the back of my car, and I rifle through all my bags or, you know, all my kind of files. And there it is. There's this coach sent me back. Here's my letter. Here's the schedule. And here's this guy, Jared Gettert. So I go over to the coach. Hey, I'm, you know, Mike, it's practice. I'm, you know, Mike Daly. I got your letter. He goes, you know, where's this, you know, Jared Gettert at? And he pointed him out, and I got to know Jared, got to know his family. We ended up, you know, drafting him in the 36th round. He was a draft and follow. Didn't, you know, end up signing. He goes to a Kansas State, becomes like a really good player, and then in 2006, the Indians, you know, draft him. He plays for like a number of years in the minor leagues, plays with Toronto and Pittsburgh, and then when I was a farm director, we had the opportunity to, you know, hire him as a hitting coach, and he's right here, out here in lovely Surprise, Arizona. But you go back to, like, I don't know if I ever get the chance to meet Jared Gettert. I don't know, you know, chance to kind of, you know, ever draft him, have a chance to, you know, be able to hire him without, you know, sending out, like, you know, all those letters, you know, back in 2003, 2004. And a 2005.
I would imagine the invention of GPS was probably the greatest thing that happened to the scouting industry, right? Next to like a radar gun, right?
I tell you what, I had like a Walmart Rand McNally big old map that I would kind of keep in my lap. My first year, I never pulled more U-turns in my entire life. I was going past it. I didn't know what was going on. So definitely, GPS is really, really good.
You joined the Rangers before the 2007 season as manager of scouting operations, dealing with both pro and international scouting. How did it come about for you to join the Rangers?
Well, in 1998, when I was there with the Philadelphia Phillies working in the ticket office, I had the opportunity to meet A.J. Preller there, and he was also in the ticket office as well. He had gotten promoted because he was so good at the single tickets up to the group ticket level, but I had the opportunity to meet him in 1998, and I had a relationship with him. I met John Daniels along the way, you know, back at some of the winter meetings back in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000. He was an intern in Colorado when I was an intern in Cleveland. So I built a relationship with, you know, both of those guys, but I really knew AJ, and I, you know, stayed in touch with AJ from 1998 when we were with the Phillies.
You move up through the organization. 2010, you're named Director of International Scouting. Do that job for 3 or 4 years, oversee the signings of Rougned Odor and Nomar Mazara, among many other players. How difficult is that international scouting situation where you're trying to project a kid who's 14 years old and not only project how his skills are going to develop, but how his physical frame is going to develop? And I mean, it seems like that would be even far more difficult than scouting a kid who's a senior in high school or certainly a college player.
No, it is a challenge, but I go back to my time as an area scout to be able to watch, you know, see all these players. I saw Max Scherzer in high school, and I missed. I didn't think that he was going to become, you know, Max Scherzer. I saw Blake DeWitt and Scott Elbert. I saw Alex Gore, and I saw Clayton Kershaw and Brett Anderson and Zach Britton and Nate Carr. I'd seen so many players over that time as an area scout. And you take some of the things that you had learned as an area scout, and you take them down, you know, internationally, and you learn from AJ, and you learn from Don Welke, you learn from, you know, like a number of people of what the differences are, but it's still down. It still comes back to like a few of the same things that you're looking for, whether he's at the University of Nebraska or whether he's down in, you know, Santo Domingo. So I was, you know, lucky enough, like I said, to be able to have some experience scouting that, you know, certainly helped me when I jumped into the international arena.
With international players, when you do bring them over here, is the bigger concern sort of how they adapt to life in the United States or North America, depending on where your teams are, more than anything else? I mean, obviously, when you're coming from a small town in the Dominican, or you're coming from, you know, Japan or wherever it may be,
sure,
there are going to be a lot of challenges that you face that somebody who was raised in Missouri might not face.
Certainly. No, and I think that it's our job to make sure that the players are as comfortable as they can be when they come to the States. I have a greater appreciation, having been in the States and spent so much time in Latin America, about what are some of the challenges that maybe, you know, these guys face. I don't speak like, you know, Spanish, you know, fluently. I speak like a, you know, good amount of Spanish, but I don't speak it, you know, I don't know how to do certain things there in Latin America. And thankfully, you know, we have like a great staff that is able to help me out. I think with those players as they come over to the States, I think that it's like a very similar situation where these guys are, you know, coming over, and it's very, very tough to, you know, hit a baseball. It's very tough to, you know, perform. It's very, very tough to, you know, do things on the baseball field. What can we do outside of the baseball field to provide them like the best opportunity to have success when they're playing?
The Rangers hadn't made the postseason for 10 years leading up to 2010. Then they made 2 consecutive trips to the World Series. What do you think the franchise, what was the moment or maybe the year that the franchise kind of turned the corner and started not only to believe, but started actually find the results to make 2010 and 11 possible?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know if there's one turning point. I think that there's like a lot of work that goes into it. I think that there's a lot of, the work that, JD, his leadership, bringing, various people, Thad Levine and Scott Servais and AJ Preller and Josh Boyd, but then also making some big time decisions. I mean, trading Mark Teixeira takes courage, but to understand, what like the vision, what it could be like with Elvis Andrews on the field, Neftali Feliz coming out of the bullpen, and Matt Harrison, that takes courage. And I think JD, his leadership and the infrastructure that he was able to put in place, and hiring Ron Washington, and I mean, there's so many good decisions along the way that JD made, and I think like all of those decisions, I think led to the turning point, and certainly led to the success that we've had in 2010 and 2011, and moving forward.
Where does Josh Hamilton's 2010 season rank for you in terms of the most impressive things you've seen on a baseball field?
It was unbelievable. I mean, I don't think that you can really put into words, but once again, trading Edison Volquez for Josh Hamilton, that was JD. JD had a gut feel. JD really believed in Josh Hamilton, in the story. He saw what he could be, but then to have Josh come in here and do what he did, it was amazing.
You went on to oversee the player development operation as senior director of player development from 2014 to 16. What are the biggest challenges of running a farm system? It seems like such an enormous undertaking to have that many players and have to try to sort of plot out a course for all of these different minor league teams.
Sure. I think like the biggest challenge is like the right people, is that you got to have really good people, whether it's coaching, medical, strength and conditioning, administratively, analytics. I mean, you need to have really, really good people, and you have to trust those people, and you have to understand that the player development department is really needs input from so many different, not just those folks, but from the scouting side, amateur scouting, international scouting, pro scouting side, what the vision is of the major league manager and the major league coaching staff. There's so many things that go into the player development department, and just balancing what the priorities are and making sure that we're focused on culture and vision and pushing forward and then putting the individual development of the player first. And there might be like a little kind of lean towards winning, and winning's important, but ultimately it's about the individual player and what we're doing to make sure that we do everything possible so that he can maximize his potential.
You picked up most of Thad's duties in major league operations and international scouting when he moved on to the Twins. What was the biggest change for you following your promotion to AGM?
I think some of the areas that I'm not probably like the strongest in, which is some of the administrative areas, like the rules, Major League Baseball rules, some of the waiver wire aspect, that really wasn't like an area that I was focused in. It was basically scouting and player development. And thankfully, I worked with Matt Vanola, who's here, and John, JD has like a great understanding of it. So they've pulled me along and taught me a lot here since I've kind of undertaken this role over the past year.
John has three assistant GMs in the front office. Each of you has specific duties, specific areas. Do you all assist each other, or is it sort of a stay in your lane situation where this is what you do and this is what they do?
No, it is not. I think that's part of our culture here, is that everybody is involved in different areas, and different people have different experiences or expertise in different areas, but we're very, very lucky that we work together, and there's a lot of collaboration. And I'm learning different areas, and other guys are learning different different things from me. So it's about openness and collaboration, working together.
Now that you've worked in the big leagues for the better part of two decades, when you think back to your experience at LSU as a player, being part of the national championship teams, does any of that ever transfer? Does any of that ever help you in this part of your career, any of those experiences?
I think everything helps. I think to kind of, I remember talking to Brad Hopp, who I was good friends with, and as I was kind of coming up, he was in the big leagues, and he just talked about the importance of making sure that you bring in the right people in the clubhouse. And like the players live with each other starting from mid-February and hopefully until late October, and if you bring in like a bad person, just wrecks the clubhouse. And I think kind of, you know, looking back at, you know, LSU was a very, very good clubhouse, but just some of those relationships that I've had with my former, you know, teammates and just getting their kind of insights. I think I just kind of go back to the importance of people and the importance of, you know, when you're putting together a club, you know, making sure that you have not only like the right players on the field talent-wise, but the right people in the clubhouse.
You broke into the game 2001, right as the analytics revolution was kind of starting.
Yeah.
How have you seen analytics most change the game, be it in player development or scouting or just, you know, just in general?
Yeah, I think that more people are in tune to it. I think, you know, when I first started, you know, Moneyball kind of came out. I, you know, scouted with like with many old school, you know, scouts, that it was all about the eyes. And I think now they're a different generation of scouts, you know, coming up that have a clear appreciation for, you know, what they see, that they, you know, understand the stats as well, or the analytics and kind of, you know, what that means either to, you know, help their, you know, help what their eyes see, or to, you know, kind of maybe question what they're seeing, you know, what they're seeing out there on the field, or what they're, you know, writing in their, you know, scouting report. So I think that it's just, it's more accepted now. It's more, you know, part of the landscape to kind of where it was when I first, you know, started in the game in, you know, 2002, 2003.
I feel like it used to be back then, especially, you were either a scouting guy or you were an analytic guy, and nary the two shall meet. Now, like you said, scouts are more accepting of it, and in some cases, the analytics are backing up. See, I told you that guy, you know, that guy took the right route to the ball, and now route efficiency is showing that you're right.
Sure, so absolutely.
It almost seems like the one or the other is a thing of the past.
I think that we are a get the best player type of team, and whether that's from what the scouts see or the you know, analytics see, I think it's a clear blend, and I think that you got to be able to understand both, and both sides, you know, give you information that are really important to help you make, you know, decisions. And yeah, it is accepted and it's important, but, you know, so are the guys, you know, out there scouting, you know, going to the high schools and the colleges, or, you know, sitting here at this ballpark today.
So now that all 30 teams have analytics departments, is there a constant push internally to stay ahead of the pack and try to figure out what that next competitive advantage might be?
I think that there's always a you know, drive to find whatever the next competitive advantage, whether it's analytics, whether it's injury prevention, whether it's, you know, player development, whether I think that there's a constant drive from all 30 teams to be able to, you know, find that next competitive advantage in the landscape, but then also recognizing that once you find it, it's going to be like a pretty short window to be able to, you know, hold on to it. So you have to continue to keep pushing and looking for different, you know, different ways of, you know, competing and, you know, staying ahead.
You know, it's funny. I remember last year Sandy Alderson told me that he doesn't spend much time thinking about finding the thing that's next. It's more perfecting what's already out there. So he said, if you discover something, you figure out some other area, it's going to be your own for 5 minutes, and then everybody else is going to hear about it, and then they're going to start doing it. So it's more about sort of putting in the work to perfect what is already out there. It seems like, you know, the idea of having a competitive advantage for any length of time because you're doing something that nobody else is doing,
right,
seems unrealistic, especially with people moving front offices as much as they do and moving team to team, or even players moving team to team saying, hey, we did this thing over at this other team, we should think about that too. Secrets are hard to keep, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. But then I think that, you know, Sandy makes a great point, like, you know, doing what you do, but, you know, doing it, you know, really well, like that's a competitive advantage as well. Is, hey, you're, you know, really good in these areas, or, you know, really good in these, you know, certain aspects. And I think, you know, as you're looking at that competitive advantage, it's not keeping your eye off, you know, what you do, what your core values are, what, you know, what you do good. You have to make sure that you, you know, protect your base, that you do, you know, do those things, you know, over and over and over again, and that should allow you, like, the opportunity to go out there and to see, you know, what are some different frontiers that you might be able to find to be able to capture that competitive advantage, even if it's for just a brief moment.
You said before that Thad and AJ, you knew they would be GMs if that's where they wanted to go, or if that's where they decided to push their efforts. Mm-hmm. Is that your ultimate goal, to be a GM in the big leagues?
Not necessarily. I'm my goal and my objective is to work with great people. And I've been lucky to work in two organizations that, in Cleveland and here, where I'm unbelievably satisfied. I'm very, very lucky to work with great people. You know, John Daniels, our ownership group, but the people who I work with, you know, each and every day, are outstanding, and I'm very, very lucky to be a Texas Ranger, and we got to do everything possible here to continue to, you know, put like a really good team on the field and build the organization. So my goal is to continue to work with like really, really good people.
You saw the Astros win their first World Series championship last year. The Rangers are still looking for their first. Has Houston's success changed the dynamic of the rivalry, changed the dynamic of the division, or put more pressure on you guys to get back there just because the team right down the road just finally got it done?
I think that there's always urgency to, you know, get back to October baseball. There's nothing better than it, than, you know, playing in October. But they've you know, Houston's had great success, and they're gonna be a very good team for a long time. But we just really have to worry about, you know, focus on what, you know, we can do and how we can get better. And but yeah, I think like the rivalry is good when, you know, we're good and Houston's good. Those games mean something. There's something about, you know, pride in Texas, and it's always fun to play for the Silver Boot.
Mike Daly, Rangers assistant GM, Major League Operations, International Scouting. Thanks very much for your time. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Many thanks to Mike Daly for taking the time to sit down for this week's episode of Executive Access. For our next episode, I'll sit down with Tigers Vice President and Assistant General Manager David Chad. We'll discuss his college coaching career, his experience as a scouting director, being part of the curse-busting Red Sox group in 2004, and much more. You can search for Executive Access on Apple Podcasts, Art19, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and enjoy these conversations all season long. If you like what you hear, leave us a review while you're at it. We always appreciate those. And be sure to spread the word and tell all the baseball fans in your life about Executive Access. Until next time, I'm Mark Feinzend.